The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Okay, so our guest this morning is Luke Keeney, who used to play football for Donegal. Myself and Luke met at the GPA's Balance 2020 conference, which was on in Croke Park recently. Luke was a panellist on a panel that we talked about. Essentially, we were trying to get to the bottom of load and player management issues, and you told your story, and it was really remarkable. So I figured it'd be good to get the full story and try and spend a bit of time with it. How old are you?
Now I'm 27.
Right, so you should be in the peak of your powers as an intercounty footballer.
Yeah, that was part of the plan.
When did you last play a game of football?
So the last time I represented Donegal was the All-Ireland final in 14 against Kerry. But my last game then with my club for Masters was 2016.
Okay, so 2016, yeah. So you're 24 when you have to retire.
Yeah, well, it was just short. Well, it meant the county career finished on the back of having, you know, the operations.
As a 22-year-old, roughly?
Well, I think it would be better to go back and talk about the storyline and how we got to...
Yeah, no, we will. Don't worry. But I just want to try... Because the point is that you should be playing at county football now, essentially.
Yeah, correct.
And that you're not. When did you start playing football?
So, I was probably 3 or 4 when I started going to the academy in Four Masters, which is a local club in Donegal Town. And, you know, that's obviously when I played my last game. But with Donegal, it was the first kind of development squads around 15.
Right. So you must have been decent.
Yeah, like, I suppose the process is you're lucky enough to get selected onto them and then work your way up. So I would have played under 16. Then we actually won the Buncrana Cup. So that was my first kind of real experience of winning anything with Donegal. And I was lucky enough to captain that team. So then obviously in the back of that, got called into a minor panel. And that was 2008. So that was a year above my age group. And then that was going into my final year in school, or series 5th year.
Yeah.
And then the year after, you had another year minor, so you played 2 year minor. And then kind of you work your way up in the ladder. So 2010, I did my leaving cert and went to UCD. So that was probably my first time getting into like a high level, because you're now called into an under-21 panel. Now I was still only 18 at the time.
And why did you go to UCD, as a matter of interest?
I wanted to be a PE teacher, and I did sports and exercise management, but unfortunately I didn't have the points, so that was kind of my second option, you know, and loved every minute of it.
Did you play football in UCD?
Yeah, so I was lucky to get a scholarship there.
Right.
And our first year in 2010, we were freshers, so you can't actually play Sigerson. But at that stage, I was in with Donegal and got actually called into the McKenna Cup team with Jim McGuinness.
Right.
So as an 18-year-old, you're playing McKenna Cup, you know, in the middle of the winter against, I think I made debut, it was Jordanstown, and then we played Tyrone. And like, you're in there, 18-year-old, and I was quite lean or kind of skinny at the time, and had the big baggy jersey, so that was an experience. But I think that's kind of the whole kind of first time, 2010, when things started getting, you know, real serious. You know, you were balancing inter-county life at that stage. Now, even though it was under-21s, I didn't stay in the senior panel. I just played under-21s that year.
Right, so you were called up for the McKenna Cup and went back to the under-21s?
Yeah, I went back. See, Jim, that was his first year taking over. So he had just, I think it was 2010, they played Dublin, Jim Gavin, and they lost the final that year, and then he applied for the senior job but also got the 21s, so that's kind of, he had to finish out both.
Yeah.
So then after March, that time of the year, we were like kind of, the senior team went on and I kind of stayed at 21s level.
Okay.
You know.
So, well, at that stage, you're playing for your club, you're playing for your county, and you're playing for UCD.
Yeah, so that was the first kind of exposure to that. But then also in UCD, you played Dublin Championship.
Right.
So, like, even though you're like there and you're on a scholarship, it's only for the first year, you have say 2 minimum teams there. You have under-21 with your club and county, and then you also have senior for your club. And then I was kind of on the cusp of senior or 21s at that age at 18.
Okay, for Donegal?
Yeah, with Donegal.
Right, so are your hips okay at that stage?
At that stage, yeah, I was unaware of anything, you know, and I think, like, looking back in hindsight, I've learned an awful lot from speaking to Damien Griffin, you know, who's the orthopaedic surgeon that we'll maybe get on to. But the knowledge known there and what I've learned looking back, would have done a lot of things differently.
Okay, well, we'll come back to what you would have done differently. Yeah. Next year, you're beginning to make it with the Donegal seniors, or when do you make
so,
it?
Yeah, so I suppose 2011, your second year UCD, you're in Sigerson panel now. You know, you're actually eligible to play O'Byrne Cup, and at that stage, I was still in my second year 21s. Now, I actually played McKenna Cup for Donegal at the start of the year, and then I also played for UCD in the same thing. Now, technically, you're not meant to do that because it's two different competitions, but because I was on a scholarship, I had to represent them. So you're balancing that there, still 19, you know, I was 19 turning 20 that year. And then it wasn't really till 2013 when I got properly called into the Donegal panel, but that's on the back of 3 years 21s.
Yeah, and okay, so that's when it gets the most busy? Because at that point you're doing the proper intercounty training.
Yeah, so that's probably when your eyes are opened up to the amount of training that the elite level is at, you know. And at that stage in 13, like, it was my final year in college in UCD, so you had three teams there: Dublin Championship, Sigerson, then you have the same with your club. You have under 21 still. Like, I was still only 21 at the time, and then your senior championship. And really, it was after 2012, so Donegal got to the Northern Final, and the club championship in Donegal was upheld. So our club, Four Masters, we got to the county semi-final that year, but we played 7 games in 28 days.
Right.
And that's really when something started in my head, or started saying, right, there's something not right here.
With your hip.
Yeah, you know, on both sides. But I suppose, then you get called into the senior panel, and, you're like, right, I have to get ready for my first pre-season. You know, you've done the 21s, you know, I was in my final year 21s, but you're kind of in then.
Yeah. So when something's not right with your hips, does that mean they're painful? That you're done a full motion, you can't sprint? What?
Well, at that stage, I just knew it wasn't, it's kind of hard to describe. It's you don't have a full, range of power, or, it's kind of catching, or, say, when you're kicking, so, the inside of your foot, it was kind of catching, or when you're running, that you felt that you're going a wee bit slower,
yeah.
But you're kind of in your head, and you're kind of pushing through that pain side of it and just getting on with it.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the training like then when you get in?
Well, my first game, or my first kind of debut, was against Dublin in the league, and we had just lost an Ulster semi-final 3 days earlier.
For the club?
No, with the all 21s.
Right, okay.
So I had to play Dublin on the Sunday, and if we'd won that game, we stayed in Division 1, and if we lost it or drew it, we got relegated. We actually drew it. And then 3 days later, I had to go and play a 21s match in an Ulster final. And, you know, you would think that a final would, you know, be more important, but at that time, you know, you were kind of following kind of orders and doing your best to get into the.
So did you play both games?
Played both games, yeah.
But full.
Yeah, full, I think that day was Mark and Darren McConley, and
nice easy
one, and the abuse started, and, you know, it was the first day we were playing. I think there might have been 14,000 or 15,000 in McCool Park, because it was a bumper game.
Yeah.
And we were just in the back winning All Ireland, you know, in 2012. So it was heated, and. Yeah, it was a nice easy one to break into, but unfortunately I think Paul Mannion kicked the last minute point. The referee actually broke his ankle, and there was 10 minutes of stoppage time.
Right.
So it just sticks in your memory.
Game. Yeah.
But then obviously the high of that, and playing your first game to get ready for an Ulster final, and then we actually came up short in that game, so it was up and down. It was a tough few days.
And how was the body after that?
Looking back, it wasn't good, but I was unaware of what was actually being done. And I think, as you know, as athletes, we just try and push through the pain barrier and tell ourselves, right, next game, it's something probably the GAA have, is there's no long-term view. It's right, next, or we have a game here, let's get ready for that. This manager wants you here. And the wider picture is kind of, you know, there is none, it's kind of puts the back of them people's minds.
Well, at that time, you have a club manager who you want to play for, you've got the intercounty senior manager who you want to play for, there's the under 21 manager you're still trying to make sure you're impressing. And have you moved from UCD to.
So it was finally at UCD, so then we had Sigerson on top of that. And then graduated that year, and then I got an opportunity to go to the University of Ulster, Johnstown, where I got a scholarship to go up there and play football.
Right.
And that was in the back of 2013.
Okay. So you're trying to, at the same time, make all these teams and play good football and build the rest of your career out. Not an easy juggling act.
No, and I think it's your balancing the training load too and the travelling. Like, when we're in Dublin, we have to travel back twice a week. So you're going back midweek. And for anyone, it's a 4-hour journey back to Letterkenny or to Convoy where we're training. And then you're leaving college at 3 o'clock in the day to get a bus to from UCD to DCU and then back to Dublin, train, get some food, hop in the car, and you're getting back into Belfield at 2 o'clock in the morning to get up to go to a lecture on Thursday morning, 9 o'clock, and then to hop in the car Friday evening to go back and do maybe two sessions then that weekend, maybe a full training session on the Saturday and a club game on the Sunday.
And how intense was the training at that point?
I suppose that was probably, you know, you're looking at that year we were, I was in with like kind of the All-Ireland winning team, and you're going into that kind of environment where the standards are so high, and we were trying to get back to that. So like you're talking, you know, some of the sessions could have been up to 2 hours, you know, and it's like we were wearing GPS, and sometimes you might have hit 12 to 13 kilometers per session, you know, and then you're kind of doing that there on a Saturday, and then going to play a full 60-minute game for your club on the Sunday, and then, you know, like you've no recovery in between that, and then you're back training then midweek then again in Dublin.
Did it feel like that was the right thing to do at the time?
Yeah, because you're in a bubble, and you just, like as a kid, all you wanted to do, well, all I wanted to do was to play for Four Masters and then play for Donegal, you know, and yeah, so there's a picture of my granddad, who's an All-Ireland winner at Galway, number 4 in 1956, you know, and he was someone that, you know, unfortunately passed away this year, but who would have looked up to him, would have been my idol. Still is, and unfortunately I never did him proud, and that's something that's kind of still lives me, and it's probably something that I unfortunately couldn't go down and show him a medal or have a photo of him with the cup. You know, there's a lot of inter-county footballers. I think the two Mannion brothers went over to visit him when they won the All-Ireland, and you know, even though it was great to see that, I was still very jealous of it, that it wasn't me there, you know. From an early stage, that's all I wanted to do, so anything kind of in terms of pain or training, you just went with it. And I think at that stage, you're 22, 23, you're in a panel, you're naive because you just want to impress. And if you're not training, you're not in the player's or in the manager's mind, or you're not going to get game time. So that's kind of tunnel vision aspect that all athletes have, I suppose.
And were there double sessions and all that kind of stuff that you hear about?
Yeah, so the kind of looking back now, one of the, you know, kind of highlights that really kind of sticks out was the pre-season for 14. So we were doing double sessions, you know, that were maybe 2 hours long, and like you're doing a physical on a Saturday and then a tactical on the Sunday, but like you're spending, you know, probably 6 hours, 7 hours in a car, and then going back to Belfast then to go to college, and like, you know, in 2014, and I wasn't fit to get out of the car by the time I got to Belfast, you know. And then
let's just go through that, because so you would go training. Give us a weekend then. What would one of those weekends be like?
Yeah, so this is around Christmas time, you know, end of 13 for the 14 season.
Right.
So we got, I think that year we got a Troughton by Mayo in the quarter final, and you know, there's obviously you had your team meeting, sit down, plan the year, kind of evaluate what went wrong in 13, and Jim actually came back that year, and there was a new management. Rory had stepped away, so new coaches, new kind of environment. So we had obviously we kind of made a commitment that we were going to put our life on hold to try and do everything to win an All Ireland. So that then entailed double sessions, you know, up on sand dunes to then, you know, in the freezing cold, running like literally on the beach beside. It's up in Dunfanaghy, so
is it a double session back to back days or two sessions in the same day?
No, well at that stage because of the size of Donegal, you could never do two sessions. You know, maybe now they might do a gym session, you know, before or after, but at in 14 it was a conditioning pitch session or a running, you know, in pre-season, and then a tactical session on the Sunday then, so right. It was kind of gameplay.
So everybody would kind of stick around for the weekends type thing?
No, you go home.
Right.
So it's like, you get up, like your whole Saturday's gone, because it's a 90-minute drive. You know, I think people like the Dublin players and people in Leinster in different areas, they've 15-20 minutes and they're home and they're getting optimum recovery. You know, like say, places like say Donegal, Kerry, Mayo, that have to spend, you know, they're either working in, or in college, have to spend more time in a car, and that's taken away from the recovery. And, you know, that's an aspect that people sometimes forget,
yeah.
Is like the logistics of where we are.
So you would do a Saturday session up the sand dunes, and then there'd be a Sunday session, and then you'd go home.
So you go home, drive back in the car, you get back maybe 6 o'clock, recover, get up the next day at 8 o'clock, drive the same way back up to Dunfanline, another 90-minute drive, do a tactical session, 90 minutes back home, get your gear, go to college.
Right. And when you said you barely fit to get out of the car when you got back, what was the cause of that? It wasn't just fatigue, it wasn't...
No, like, so, that it's... looking back, and now that I'm educated, that, like, you know that there was something wrong, but I was carrying my hip, like, I was... like, it was painful walking, you know, it was taking me maybe 3 days to recover, and looking back, I just thought that was... because it was my second year, I didn't really know what damage was done. You're kind of not afraid to speak up because, you know, you just want the train, the play, and I didn't really know what was wrong. And like, you're struggling to, you know, get on your socks the next day, and when you're showering, you know, like, you're 23, you should have like no pain, you should be fit to be, you know, recovering well. And that obviously wasn't the case in my story. Like,
okay, so at what point then do you realise this isn't normal and I do need to actually see somebody or speak up or have a conversation with somebody about this?
So I think after we lost All Ireland, you know, I was kind of just graduated from Johnstown, you know, just finished my master's up there. So, you know, you had your undergrad in UCD, your master's there. I was kind of like, right, 23, I've seen what it's taken, and we've got so close. Like, I think Colin McFadden hit the post in the last 2 minutes and we could have won it. And that's how close you were from success and fulfilling your dream. But I kind of was like, right, an opportunity to go to America for work. So I went away to Texas on a grad visa. Still worked for the same company, so I've kind of, it was a trip well worth it. So I went there for about 11 months. And over there, I think my body got a full break. Played a bit in AFL because I couldn't play Gaelic over there because the team's only a junior club, and it meant that I had to transfer for Masters. But coming back then, we had a relegation game, I think it was like the 22nd of December, and the club flew me home a day extra earlier, so played that match and actually broke my collarbone. And as you can imagine, it wasn't a nice Christmas after coming home, and yeah, I had to get a plate and 6 pins put in. So at that stage, Rory Gallagher was the manager, and he'd been in contact with me in 2015, and I was kind of doing a bit of training to get ready. And I was like, look, there's obviously the shoulder injury kind of took me out of action and gave my hips a bit of time to, because obviously there was no load going through them. But I was like, I was with the physio at the time, Tommy Gallagher, who did all my rehab, and I was like, Tommy, there's something wrong with my hips. And
still?
Yeah, but I hadn't, like, I suppose for them 2 or 3 years when you're playing your college football and you're playing for Donegal, you're dealing the pain, you know, you're not getting to the source of the problem. You're like, I was getting intensive physio, I was getting dry needling, you know, you're getting hydro pool, you know.
So the year that you reached the All-Ireland after the double sessions and you're travelling back up to Jordanstown and you're doing those weekends, you're still on the fringes of the team, you're making the team.
Yes, I made my debut that year, so we played Derry in the first round of Ulster, came on there and played that. I'd played in Crow Park in the league. Like, I was knocking on the door.
And to get to play, though, it requires like a couple of hours of warm-up and loosening the
hips. Yeah, so you have your prehab work, so you had your routine before the game, but like after the sessions I was getting maybe an hour of physio every Sunday after training.
From the Donegal team physio?
Yeah, from, and then, you know, then we had our own masseuse as well, and then say up in Johnstown, you might have been going and getting extra work done, you know, in between the sessions.
And is this just normal? Are loads of people getting that done? Or is everybody...
Yeah, well, that's part of your recovery, because like I suppose as we're amateur athletes, we don't have the luxury of
resting,
and that's kind of the big thing. So I think you get, when you have the opportunity and you have the physio or you have the masseuse around, you optimize it. Yeah,
absolutely. But at the same time, like, are people not going, geez, he's getting a lot of physio every game to make sure that he can play?
Yeah, well, it's like you're going to do whatever it takes to get on the pitch, and the medical team are doing whatever they can to make sure you're eligible to play.
Yeah.
And that's just
everybody's. That's the contract.
That's the GA. That's every kind of. Well, that's every across any sport. You're going to do whatever it takes to get on the pitch.
But
you know,
in some sports, they would take you out of that and say, "We're going to get you well, and when you're well again."
Yeah. Well, that's going back to the whole training load and monitoring and like the kind of identifying problems that might arise and screening at early ages and all that. And that's a completely different thing that's only starting to come into the GA now, that maybe has been in say professional sports for years.
Yeah. Okay. You go away for a year and you come back, mm-hmm. and you break your collarbone in the club game.
Yeah.
And Rory's saying come back, and yeah. you're saying, yeah, okay, I will come back, but I want to get well.
Yeah. So that's, I suppose, my conversation with him was like, look, I'm mad keen to be get back involved in the setup, but I want to get an MRI on both hips. So that happened probably around September, kind of November in 2015.
Right, so you're Donegal intercounty footballer at this stage.
Yeah.
You're saying, off you go, let's get the hips looked at, and, you know,
It was 2016, excuse me. I forgot it was Texas. So just a small thing. Yeah.
And at that point, you're thinking, this is fine. The MRI is going to show up something. Did you know?
I knew there was something wrong. Like, you're a 24-year-old and your hips, you're carrying your hip as you're walking. You know, like, people are going, why are you limping? You know, why are you in pain all the time? Like, I had no rotation in my joint. So, like, the warning signs were there, but, like, my mindset was, right, let's get this fixed, get the operation, and get ready for league football or championship, you know. And then when we got the MRI results, you know, there was a bit of a red flag moment, you know.
Yeah. What happened with that red flag at that stage?
So the MRI results, got them done, Donegal. They were sent over then to the doctor. They kind of looked at it and they were like, look, we need to see an orthopedic surgeon. So at that stage, you know, I'd spoken to a few different individuals. One of them was Josh Van de Flair, who I lived with in UCD, and just asked him. He'd gone to see a specialist about his hip, and there was different other players I think there was a player from Kerry and a few from Donegal that had gone over to see Professor Damien Griffin.
Right.
So he
had a reputation.
Yeah, so I kind of done my homework, and I kind of known that, right, I wanted to see the best. He was the best available in Europe. So I was like, right, if I'm going to have anyone look at it, I'm going to see him.
And when you get over to him, what does he see?
So it was January 17 was the first time we had a conversation, and his process was, anything that was done in Ireland, he wanted to double check it. So went over on my own at this stage, had to get two MRIs on both hips. I had to get ink injected into it. I had to get 3D imaging and X-ray. So you're going over on your own, that whole process. I had to pay for all that myself, and then sit down in a room with him, similar to this here. And then
why are you paying for that yourself when you're a Donegal footballer going to get your hips fixed to go and play football for Donegal?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and I suppose maybe we might touch on that later on when we get into the actual, you know, the different operations that I needed and how that whole process was handled.
Okay, well, we can do that now if you want before we get into the it doesn't make any sense as an outsider. Did they say, oh no, you've got to go to this guy and this guy because that's what we want you to do, or what was
not necessarily. I suppose I just said to them, this is the best, I want to see him, so I was going to him.
Right.
And
are they like, well, you're not technically a member of the panel? Are they wriggling away?
Yeah, there's that whole side of it, and you know, that put it added stress, you know, from on me and my family. Like, you're in the mindset as a player, right? I'm going to get better. This is what I need to do. Let's get it done as soon as possible and get back playing.
Yeah.
And normally you want the support from the county board and the different avenues to make sure you're going to get back to your full recovery, be your physio, your S&C, your doctor. And I was there going, right, this is what I'm doing. without the support.
Right. You would seem, again, from the outside, that this is a collaboration where it's in their interest to get you well, to go and play again. And at this point, everybody thought you were going to play again.
Yeah.
That bit.
And I still, like, from the first meeting and having that, was only after seeing the 3D imaging that something wasn't right.
And you begin to realise this.
Yeah, and like, you're sitting there and he's showing you your hip and there's lumps on it, there's, you know, there's, you can show like where the bone is deformed, you know, but like, I suppose I was still there, right, we'll get this and we'll do this operation, I'll be fine. And then I had to go back then at the end of January, 17, and what they did was they knocked me out and examined my hips under x-ray. So that was extremely painful. You can imagine you're knocked out, you're drugged up, and then all of a sudden them drugs wear off.
Yeah.
And I couldn't walk for 2 days. I was bedbound, couldn't sleep because of the pain. And I was like, right, this isn't normal. So again, follow on, we get to February. And I was like, you know, Professor Griffin was like, we need to get you examined. So that's when they went in with a keyhole. So
the intention with the keyhole is to fix it.
And the whole idea of it is to go in, repair and correct the damage that's done. So the plan was to go in, there's three keyholes, and like to fix the labrum, which was like completely torn off the bone. So I had to replace the labrum, shave off the ball. You know,
what's the labrum? Just for anybody who doesn't.
The labrum's like it's the cartilage that's in your joint. That's okay. Kind of like, you know, kind of protects it and manages kind of the whole. Not that I'm too technical now, but
the relationship.
Between the whole movement, and then like obviously that's your ball and socket, and then there's cartilage in between it. So when Damien, Professor Griffin went in, he went in to fix that. But obviously when he went in and seen how bad the hip was and how degenerate it was, he knew there was something badly wrong. So that was probably one of the hardest things, that he just literally after 20 minutes, he shaved off a bit of the bone, but 20 minutes closed me up. And the next day I'm sitting there in commentary on my own thinking, right, brilliant, got this done, get back fit.
So you wake up.
Wake up, comes in and says, look, there's bad news. And then, you know, that's probably one of the most hardest points. But again, I still thought I might have an option. If maybe I don't get back playing at elite level, I might get back playing for my club. So then there was like a 3 or 4 month window when, you know, I'm back in Donegal, and at that stage I had to fund the whole first operation in March, the keyhole. So that's 13,000. So you can imagine I'm there doing everything in my power to get myself available for selection for Donegal, but I had to go to my family. I had to get a loan out of that there. You can imagine the stress that put my mother under, you know, and the family, and then...
And you're not even well at the end of it.
You're not even well, but like, you're, as an athlete, you should be just, your sole focus is on recovery, not battling with insurance companies, trying to get funding for this, doing paperwork. I had to do all that myself. And then on the back of it, then they get hit with the news that, right, this wasn't a success. So that was probably one of the hardest points looking back on it. And then obviously that led to getting, you know, a metal on metal hip resurfacing, which I had then a few months down the line.
We've got some images of the metal on metal resurfacing. I don't understand any of this stuff, so if you can explain. So there's the metal, that's the posts.
Yeah, that's post surgery, so I think that's maybe...
This is your right hip, right?
Yeah, that's my right hip. So as you can see,
on the left hand side, but it's obviously your right hip. And there's three pins and a giant lump of metal in it.
Yeah, so if you can imagine, what happens there is where the pins are, there's a kind of small crack, but what happens there is there's like a butterfly effect where they open up your joint like this, and then they go in. And the difference between a resurfacing and an actual replacement is it's still my hip. A replacement, they cut out the actual ball and the ball part, and they replace it with an artificial part.
Right.
Here's still my socket, so I have, say that's the ball.
Yeah.
They put a cap on top of it, so you can see that there, and then the shaft's going down, so that's a metal shape.
It's like
a part of it.
Implant almost.
Yeah, and then you can see just the outer part. So if imagine that's the socket, you can see the, you know, the wee cup at the back. So that's, they have to physically like hammer that in.
Right.
And that's an 8-hour procedure.
It's pretty gruesome. There's some footage of that, which we'll get to in a minute, of what that actually looks like. And so these are just a collection of the various images.
Yeah.
You can kind of see the scarring there in the aftermath. And we'll get into the recuperation. If you want to roll the actual footage, we can show that now. This is pretty gruesome, so if you're in any way squeamish, then I probably would look away from it. But How much of this did you actually know before it happens?
Like, he kind of don't want to really know exactly what happens. Obviously, you do your research and you find out what happens, you know, in terms of there's actually two pieces of metal being hammered into you. So you can see that's there, me knocked out. So that's my hip being hammered at there with a hammer and chisel. Yeah. And that's them putting the actual socket, or, you know, the metal part into the socket. And that's them cleaning out, getting the ball ready. So obviously, you don't feel anything at the time. You know, it's an 8-hour procedure. But looking back, it is gruesome. And it's not for the... It's not easy on the eye.
No. And here's the thing. Like, if you feel at that stage like it's worth it because you need it for day-to-day life.
Yeah,
and for the
I think after looking at that there, it wasn't really until I met Damien Griffin that I kind of knew exactly what I was dealing with. And what I mean by that is that the first conversation I had at 24 was like, you're going to need your both hips replaced at some stage. Now, that's in January. This is without knowing exactly what we had to do. So I had to, first of all, I was like, right, I didn't even know there was something that badly wrong. But he's like, right, you're going to need two replacements, possibly three in your lifespan. I didn't even have a girlfriend. I didn't know where my life was going. I couldn't even think about having grandchildren. And he's like, you have to think long term. You have to think about your quality of life when you're 70, that you're not in a wheelchair, that you're fit to get up each day pain-free, put on your socks, walk down the stairs, not after having three or four replacements and needing crutches. And you're there, you're 24, and I'm thinking, I just want to get back playing, not thinking of quality of life in my later years. And that's just a completely, you know, the mental side of that there and trying to grasp that is something that you're still trying to get around, you know. So then I was left with the option of getting a replacement or the resurfacing. At least there now I have a quality of life that I can, you know, I'm pain-free, I can exercise and get back in the gym, but obviously can't play football.
Yeah, so what's that process like? Because coming off that surgery, which is fairly brutal, but obviously it does give you some sense that you are going to be able to walk, and you are pain-free now. Well, you can't play again.
No, I can't play again at any level. And unfortunately, that's something I'm still coping with and still trying to deal with, and I don't think I'll ever get to it. But it's funny, like, after looking at that, the 8-hour procedure was probably the easiest part, and the week in the hospital, and, you know, that's because you know that's what you have to do. It's an aftermath. Like, I had to go and find my own physio.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy Gallagher, who did an unbelievable job. I had to get my own strength conditioner, Aaron Kyles, who got me back walking again. You know, and you can see maybe there's some images of trying to
walking for the first
time. Yeah, first time. So you can see, like, that's my first time after 8 weeks been on crutches. And, like, you can see there, I'm like Bambi. Yeah. But, like, that there is something that, you know, I had to manage on my own. And the big thing is the isolation part that a lot of people don't really understand. You know, from my point of view, is I had isolation of my whole dream was shattered. My intercounty career was gone. All I wanted to do was to play football. I was my identification was the Donegal footballer. Here's Luke Keeney, you know, and people in the street, and that's gone overnight. So you're still trying to deal with that. I'll probably never fill that void. It's acceptance, but you have that, trying to deal with that first of all. But then you have the isolation part. Is you're 25 or 20, a 25 year old man that had to leave his apartment, move back home. Like, I was bedbound, I couldn't shower, I needed my family to help me. And that was probably one of the hardest parts of the whole journey. It's like the isolation of being on your own, that you can't carry a plate, you're non-weight bearing, so you can't put anything, you can't put your foot down the ground. You know, I was taking a lot of, you know, painkillers, I was taking morphine to deal with the pain. That was having side effects where I was becoming very angry, you know, and probably volatile. And that was a very stressful point on my family because, you know, you have to move home. My two brothers, Jack and David, were doing junior cert and leaving cert. My mum was trying to balance that whole side to keep the whole thing together. You know, my sister was away and she was trying to be supportive. But there was a lot of dark days. And looking back, I couldn't even fend for myself. And taking that independence away and just, it's just the loneliness, you know, because no one else can do anything. You know, if there's the rehab side, but there's also the mental side. And I think it's important, like, when I was at my lowest point and it was dark days, I had to get counselling, and the GPA were brilliant and provided that service, you know. And I can't speak highly enough about that, because when you're on your own and there's no one else there and helping you, and like my family and friends are there, but they have to get on with their life, and you're lying there, and like, I wasn't fit to work. All I could do was lie to watch Netflix or read a book.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with the pain. So like, the highlight of my day was trying to do my rehab, but like, I still was dealing with the demons of not being fit to play, and the isolation, and just realising everything that I worked towards since a kid was gone.
How did the counselling work for you? What was the, like, is it just the process of talking out?
I suppose I kind of, because I'm the eldest in the family, I'm kind of, you kind of have this kind of idea that you have to be the strongest there. And from my point of view, like, I hit rock bottom because I had no support. I had my family and friends, but that was it. And you're there and you're like, you know, you're getting out of bed, and what do you have to look forward to? Mm. So it's more just talking to that and speaking about it and getting it off your chest, because even though it's very difficult to have that conversation with your family, because they're seeing you're suffering.
Well, and also they you know, they don't agree with you that you need to be strong, because they want you to be,
yeah,
and help you.
Yeah,
so,
and like,
everybody's locked in this kind of difficult situation where,
yeah, and they're trying to keep your spirits positive, but like, deep down they're heartbroken as much as you are. And like, there's a lot of emotional days when you're just crying and you're on your own and you're like, what do I have now? Like,
and you're off your head on like very high profile,
yeah,
very high power drugs.
Yeah.
And
on top of that, like, people may forget this, but like, you've gone from being an inter-county footballer, but then you're also a 25-year-old man. You've no social life. I couldn't drive and no independence. I wasn't fit to go and meet my friends or go and have a beer, or like, even if you did go have a beer, you couldn't even, because you're on medication and you're the fear of falling and you're still on crutches. And like, and the other thing is, there's a part of you that you're, not that you're like kind of ashamed, but like, you're meant to be this footballer, and now all of a sudden you can't walk, and you're kind of in your head, like, that's eating at you, that you're like, you should be out there and doing your club and your family proud, when you're not fit to even, you know, tie your shoelace, like, or put on your socks.
Yeah, well, all of which doesn't make any sense when you actually,
no,
you know, when you think it through, yeah, when you say it out loud, but you can totally see how you get trapped in this situation.
Yeah.
And I presume that's where counselling comes in and begins to,
yeah, well, that eases the burden, but like, you just have to be mentally tough, and you just have to get on with life. You know, at the end of the day, you still have them demons. You're going to be batting that every day. I still struggle to go and watch my club play. Some of my best friends still play for Donegal. I struggle to go watch them. I'm always going to be a supporter, but I'm always going to be jealous of them. It's the same, like, my sister plays for the Donegal Ladies. I'm going to support them, but there's a part of them being jealous. Brother plays professional football in UCD, and there's part of me there, you know, that is, why are they fit to do it and I can't anymore, you know? And that's, even though I'm proud and I'm delighted they're fit to do that, that's been taken away from me, and you know, you still have to deal with it.
Are you angry?
I think at the time, like, for them 2 or 3 years, I think time's a great healer. And now, you know, coming along to see where I've come from, I think the anger's kind of gone away from me. Like, don't get me wrong, I still ask why this happened and what we could have done differently. And hindsight's great that you can look back and maybe if I'd done this, I would have been playing longer. Because at the end of the day, even though I had all these operations, a lot of it could have been prevented. And that's probably the hardest part. And there's like, if you're still angry and you're holding on to something, that's just not good for your headspace. And you kind of have to let that go. Like, it's like a grieving process.
I'll talk about what you could have done differently in just a minute, but yeah. I want to play this clip as well. This is your mum, Deirdre, talking about the impact that had on the family. Because I, yeah, think that's one of the other things that people don't understand, that this isn't just your burden to carry.
Of course.
It's everybody else as well. So have a look at this. Yeah.
Right, well, the local GA community, certainly in the club here, I think the club has been very supportive insofar as they can be. As in, I suppose probably the biggest hurdle we had to overcome was the finance. You know, I mean, the operation had to be financed. because that we had gone quickly and because the procedure was being taken place over in England, the VHI weren't prepared to cover it fully, and that was a long haul trying to get all those forms and all filled in. So there was a huge sense of the financial worry. From a county board point of view, I could not say they were supportive. I could say there was no contact. There was nobody from the county board. Made a phone call, made a text, rang Luke up to see how he was. There was people I would have met since, been at AGMs, and would have known that I was Luke's mother, and they never once came and said, "How's Luke? We heard he'd bad injuries." Not so. From that point of view, it was disappointing. Disappointing for Luke also. You know, I mean, I don't really expect, I suppose, now at this stage in my life, I don't really expect people to be coming running after you with money or with support. But I feel for Luke that Luke had played football with Donegal since he was 15. He'd been on a minor squad, he'd been on the under 21 team, he'd been with the senior team. And for nobody on the county board to come forward and even pick the phone and say, "Look, how are you doing?" Do you know, at the beginning, I think there was a sense of disbelief. I think both from Luke and from me. I think we kind of felt, I suppose initially when he got the MRI scan done, we felt, well, this can't be too serious, and he'll get done and he'll go in and he'll have an operation, he'll be sorted and he'll be back playing. And I think that was why Luke pushed the first procedure so quickly. I think we felt that he would go in, get it done and he'd be back playing. But then when Professor Griffin explained that he wouldn't be coming back playing, that he had extensive damage done to his right hip, I think that hit home a lot. And from my point of view, I don't think it was so much that Luke wouldn't be playing football again. I think it was his sense of disappointment. Because, like, of any of the children growing up, Luke probably was the one. You know, he was so passionate about football. He was, like, Luke's dream from when he was 8 and 9 was always to play with Donegal. He always was, you know, every night I'd say going to bed, he used to have this footballer's prayer beside his bed. And I'd say he said it every night, and his dream was always to play for Donegal. And more than the others, I think he was so passionate about Gaelic football. And then I think that sense of disappointment for him, that, you know, he probably never got a chance to be the brilliant player he could have been. You know, that this injury was now, he wasn't even going to be able to play with this club. And I think that was a huge, huge blow. For him, for me, it was his disappointment. Not that I wouldn't see him lining out again, although that was disappointing, but that his dreams couldn't be realised. That was the biggest hurdle, I think, for me.
It's raw. No, I'm not going to lie, like, pulling down hard strings there, watching it, like, trying to keep it together a bit.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. Yeah. Like, you talked about it being your identity. That's the hardest part, I presume, is that you do give your life to this, and then ultimately the bits that you could have been looked after in a way that would have prevented this didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so you should, at 27, be playing for Donegal. You shouldn't be in here talking. There should be a media ban because you're not allowed to talk to us.
True.
Like, that's where we should be here, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know how you ever make peace with that.
I don't think I will, if I'm being honest here. You just want to go out and try and educate people and make sure that what's happened to me doesn't happen to anyone else. And I suppose I'm kind of hoping that sharing my story and, you know, documenting it and, you know, hopefully raising a bigger issue might make sure that this doesn't happen to anyone else. And that's probably the whole aspect of today and where I'm kind of trying to go with it, because this journey, like, there was a lot of dark days and no one should really have to go through that.
We didn't even talk about the fact that we talked exclusively so far about your right hip, the left hip, you had to have surgery too and recover.
Yeah, so what had happened then, when I got the resurfacing, I had 8 weeks of rehab, or 8 weeks on the crutches, and then another 4 or 5 weeks where I had to build up my right side to then get my left one done. So what happened then was, I got keyhole, and then I got, like, because my cartilage on my right side was completely gone, I had to get the resurfacing. But on the left side, there was like a 3-inch segment of it that was gone. Yeah, that's the resurfacing, so gruesome enough. But what they did was they drilled into the actual ball part to create new blood cells. Right. Create, like, so what they did was put a stem graft in, I don't know if we can get the image up of it, but you can see then they would drill in and that would create, you know, new blood flow that would speed up. So it's like an artificial cartilage. So, and then they shaved off the ball and the socket. So that operation that I got done on my left side, if my hip wasn't so badly damaged, I still would be back playing at some level.
You could have got that done on your right side much earlier before it degenerated totally.
Of course, yeah.
Right, okay. And what would fix that in future when you're saying that you're telling this story to prevent this from happening again? Load management, so not allowing somebody to play for 10 or 12 teams over the course of a 14-month period where every manager wants them to play and they're saying, well, come on, you've got a scholarship here, you've got to play, this is the club, you've got to play, this is your county team, you've got to play. Everybody wants you to play. And in everybody's mind, they're the big dog and they're the ones who like need you to be the one who's going to get them over the line in this competition that defines everything. What if you could tap yourself as a 16-year-old on the shoulder and say, right, Luke, this is what you're going to do to make sure you've got the ability to play with your grandkids or to continue to play for four Masters, what would you be saying?
Well, that was the first question I asked Professor Griffin the first time I met him. I was like, why me? Or like, why has this happened? You know, and looking back and from that knowledge I gained then, I wish I had that conversation 4 or 5 years because that would have saved my career and we would have been able to put the right training methods in place to prolong my career. And that's probably the hardest part of telling my story, that I know now that it could have been handled correctly. And it's very difficult to pinpoint where or what you can actually do. But the big thing from chatting to him was that as a 17 to 22 in the GA, we load our players. So instead of, say, in England or, say, in a professional environment, they have one team and they're pulled away from everything else and they're controlled. And that manager has the final say on that and their whole medical team works around that. In the GA, you have 3 or 4 different, maybe 5 teams in 1 year and they're pulling at you and there's no communication from the manager. There's no one controlling your load. So you might do, you could do 7 pitch sessions and have 3 games in a week and no one knows exactly what you've done in that.
And asking 17-year-olds to be communicative and expressive. Oh,
yeah, of course. And
you know, self-confident enough to go, actually, I'm not doing that because I've already done my stuff. It's crazy.
If you go back, like 18-year-old going into a senior change room after doing, sitting there watching their heroes and then going into play and then you have to speak up and say, well, hold on here, I've a session here with Georgetown or UCD or my club game and they're like, well, you're training here and we need your training. And that's the bigger issue because no matter if you have a 10-year lifespan at intercounty football, you might have 4 managers and then 4 managers want to get the best out of you. So how do you control what's happening to the player? And at the end of the day, it's on the player's shoulders. They need to speak up, but we, and no one now, the GA need to take that off their shoulders. Yeah. And, you know, we need to make players aware that they need to speak up and be stronger. And through the GPA's, you know, reps and the support there, they need to educate the players that they need. But that's only one side of it. You know, is there a case to say that, like, we have a central, you know, a central area where all the data is stored on players, but like that's talking thousands, you know, like
GDPR issues and maybe players have an app where at the end of every session they put it on, but then again it's on the player's responsibility and they forget to do it.
A club team, how do they control that? They have no GPS. Like if you're in a professional environment, your load's managed by that's a person's job to control that.
Yeah,
inter-county teams have that now and that's great, but universities don't, and the inter-county teams aren't going to share with the universities, and the clubs aren't going to share with the county teams. So it's a communication issue, as well as a training load issue.
A personalised training program, would that have worked for you?
Yeah. Well, after speaking to Professor Griffin and knowing that there was underlying issues there that maybe could have been handled correctly, but until you actually know what's there.
Yeah.
So like, for an example,
the first time you had hip pain, you should have had the MRIs.
Yeah, like if you're a player at a professional environment, right, you're an asset to them, so they're going to make sure that, you know, you're performing at the best level. right? So they do every single test. There's no cost to it. They're just making sure you're a thing. In the GA, you know, if you're not every player, if you're going to the medical team, you've soreness here, they're just treating the pain. And it's not because they would love to send everyone to them, right? That's back down to the medical side of the facilities aren't there, or it's costing X amount, and that goes back to then a county board paying for that.
Yeah.
You know, like, wouldn't it be great that, like, there was a whole facility that any injury, you just go in and it's covered, and you don't have to worry about that?
Yeah.
Where, say for me, I had to go and worry about who's going to pay for it and how I was going to get that money back. You know, and I suppose I didn't really touch on that, but like, you can imagine there's a great expense to all my operations. You have 5 procedures in 1 year, you're seeing the top surgeon in Europe, you're flying across, you have to get physio, you have to get S&C, you have to learn how to walk again. All that there came at a large price, and I was very lucky that I had the support of the GPA through the beneficiary fund to, you know, to help me through that. And just even to take that weight off my shoulder and that burden, and just allow me to actually focus on my recovery, not to worry about all them other aspects, the financial side. And that, for even my mum and the family, that was just a huge weight, you know, lifted.
Yeah. But you had to go through the whole process, like, with the county board first to get to the point where...
Well, there was no process. It was literally, I had to get the money myself, and I got it. And then I had no support. So then I had to try and find somewhere, and through the GPA they stepped in and then presented my case to get awarded the funds to cover the injuries.
Right.
And like, let's not forget, I'm going to have to get my left hip replaced in maybe 10 years. The resurfacing has a 10-year lifespan, 15 maybe, it just depends on how you look after it. So you're talking 50s needing maybe 2 more operations, and then potentially depending, like, hopefully in that time, you know, the science and the equipment has got better, so it might last longer. But this is the realisation that I have to face. So I have, even though I have had all these operations, I still have to take care of them.
And you'll have to have them again.
Yeah.
Right. That's difficult to deal with, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. It's not like, but again, we all in life have setbacks, and we all get knocked, and we're all going to have our own issues. So you just have to power through.
Before we let you go, there's just 2 last things I want to talk to you about. One was, we saw your mum talking earlier on about the county board.
Yeah.
What's the relationship like with the county board now?
There is none, to be honest.
Which is a bit strange, given that you played for Donegal for 10 years from the time you were first available to them at 15. So,
yeah.
What happened?
That's a good question. There's been no kind of follow-up, or there's been no kind of emails or even a letter just to check in, you know, and that's probably something that I still can't really understand, if I'm being honest.
Like, is that because they feel, I don't know, I mean, I don't want you to speculate on what they feel, but maybe they feel a little bit that they could have looked after you a little bit better.
I don't know. You know, like I can't say enough about, you know, the Dr. Kev Morn and the medical side, because when I was there, they helped me through it and got me to see Damien Griffin, who inevitably has made my life better, but like, there's been no contact.
Do you think, Luke, if you'd been kicking 1-6 or 1-7 a game, or if you were an all-star, that they might have treated you differently?
Potentially, I don't know. I don't think I'd ever kick 1-6, first of all. But yeah, like, that's, again, like, I that's something that I don't really know, and I can't really answer, because, like, I think the bigger issue is that the GA as a whole, no matter if you're the best player for that calendar year, or you're a 5-time All-Star, 7-time All-Ireland winner, it doesn't really matter. The GAA has a duty of care to their player. So at the end of the day, if we're representing and we're doing our most for our club and our parish, and something happens, the minimum you should expect, is to be looked after. And in my case, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Until the GPA stepped in.
And that's clear that was a hugely important moment in this. Roy Keane had that famous quote about players being a piece of meat whenever Yapstam got transferred off. You must feel a little bit like that.
Yeah, like...
You were useful for a period of time when you weren't useful.
And you're thrown away. And that's probably something that I still kind of ask why, you know, and I think that's a bigger issue that everyone needs to realise, that if you don't train or you're not fit to perform, you're in the sidelines and you're not in the manager's plans, and it doesn't really matter what you do, and you have to get back on the pitch. And that's the nature of sport, and that's the cutthroat of it. But that was
the other thing I wanted to talk to you about. The best ability is availability. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of thing that we hear so much from all sports.
Yeah.
But if you're not available, and if you're only going to be at 60 or 70% of what you're capable of doing, you shouldn't go out, because ultimately you're not.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, that goes back to it. And maybe professional sports are different because you're able to, you know, predict and control what they're doing.
And have a long-term view.
And you have it, all the data is available to say, right, well, if you don't pass a certain test or you're not available to do that, you know, you can't train. But in any team, or you chat to any intercounty footballer or hurler, if you're in the sideline, it's the loneliest spot. And that's the way it is. You know, like, it's different when it's your career and you're working your way back to get back to fitness, to get your wage for your job. But in the GA, if you're not training, you're a nobody. And that's the long and the short of it.
So you couldn't, like...
I was training at maybe, like, looking back and knowing what I know now, I was them two, 13 and 14, playing for the senior team and playing in Ulster Championships and playing in league finals and going on training camps and getting to an All-Ireland final and devoting 10, 12... Like, you know, like, you talk about pre-season, you're saying pre-season starts maybe in November, and you might, like, we started training in November and we got finished in September. You know, that's nearly a full, like, you're talking like the best part of a calendar year. You're putting your life on hold for that there, and then all of a sudden, what? You know?
And all the time, that training was actually the wrong thing for you.
Wrong thing for me, because I was pushing my body, and I was going through the pain, and I was probably only going at maybe 50 or 60% on my right side. And I don't even know what my left side would have been. Like, there's obviously an issue there because I've damaged them both. But, like, I, like, remember not being fit to, like, sprint a full tilt because of my right side. And if during that time, if I hadn't got all the work done, I wasn't even able to train. But even when I was training, it was only at 70%, do you know? So, like, that's the pressure as a 22 and 23-year-old you're on. And then trying to come into a team and speak up and go to the manager, well, I'm sore, I can't train. And they're like, well, if you can't train, you're not going to be in my plans for the league game at the weekend. And then you're going back to your college manager or club manager and you have the same issue, you know. And until we take that burden, is the way I think about it, off the actual player's shoulders, because even though it's incredible to play for all them teams, you're still the person who's, you know, in the middle, and you're the person who has to do it all. But no one's looking out for your best interests.
In America, again, the NFL restrict the amount of time that players are allowed to train, and mm-hmm. there's serious repercussions if teams break that. I don't know if that would ever work because there's no contracts here.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, first of all, like, it was incredible to hear that, but, like, it goes back to, it was the players that are pushing that. They're demanding, this is the minimum sessions I'm allowed to do. Now, it's very easy when you're the actual moneymaker and that your people are paying millions to watch you. Like, in a GA point, I don't know where it could go, but I think we have to have the players' interests, you know, best or put first, because, you know, without the intercounty players, there'd be no games, or there'd be no club structures, or, like, kids don't have any idols to look up to. So that's just at the elite level, not even talking about club level. But, like, how do you control all that? That's the challenge. You know, but I think there needs to be more responsibility on the GA to try and come up with some solution that, like, is it the fixtures are better structured? We all know that's a huge issue. But if you have correct structures in your games, that's going to take away from the training load. Is there too many training sessions to games?
Yes.
Is the season too long?
Yes.
Is the club season then, like, you're going back to your club, and you're after a 10-month calendar or 10 months of being flogged.
If you look at the Donegal County final this year as well, it's similar situation to you when you were talking about.
Yeah, like, and that goes back to it. You go back, I've seen there a Dublin League final was played like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Like, the club players are getting absolutely shafted as well, But like, it's the bigger issue that the GAA have to look at is how do you condense everything, that if there's a better structure, there's more control over the player and less chance of injury.
Yeah, no, I actually think everything comes back to the structures. If you get those right, then you can begin to monitor players.
Exactly, and you get the
different
control,
age grades,
yeah,
as well. So you haven't heard from the county board and there's no relationship there.
I think that's how rootless sport is. You know, you, in any aspect, you give your life for something, you know, but like, I don't know what to expect from it. Like, well, it's not going to change my life. It's not going to change my story. You know, I'm still going to get up in the morning. I'm still going to have metal inside me. Still can't play for my club or my county. That's, you know, the bones of it.
Was any of it worth it? The fact that you did make it to the Donegal senior inter-county team, that you did get to play with your idols?
It's a good question. Yes, obviously, because that's what you wanted to do and you wanted to get to that level. And, you know, I was very lucky to win an Ulster championship, you know, and some of my best friends are made from that. And look, looking back, is it all worth it now, knowing what I've gone through? I think there's part of me that I just wish I got to maybe 30, 31, that I had a chance to maybe try and see, you know, to become hopefully a regular in the team, to be, you know, starting and trying to hopefully push on, because even though it's great being part of a team environment, you're always going to be selfish, and it's very hard that being part of something that's winning and not really contributing. Like, you might only play 5 or 10 minutes here, you know, and before I got injured, I was like on the ladder, so to speak, that you know, like, I was fortunate to play with some of the best players Donegal's ever produced, an All-Ireland winning team, you know, All-Stars. You know, you have Michael Murphy, who's probably one of the best footballers ever to play the game, you know, and you're honoured to be in that environment. But you, from a personal point of view, you don't, until you're actually playing and being in the team and contributing, that's where the rewarding part is.
And showing what you could do.
Yeah.
Living up to your full
potential. And that's probably the part that I didn't get to, and mum addressed it. That's probably the hardest part, that if I did manage to play them years and get to that level and compete at the top table or at any level, at least then, you know, I'd have a small bit of satisfaction, you know. And I think when I did get, like, kind of look at it, when I was getting to the worst stage, you're on an upward trajectory and you're thinking, right, you know, in 14, you know, we got to the Sigerson final, I'd won an All-Star with the college that year, played in the league final, debut in the seniors, and you're getting to an All-Ireland final, you're thinking, right, this is the way it's going. And then all of a sudden you just fall off the cliff and bang, your dream's over. So to answer the question, that's probably the hardest part. You know, if you got to the stage where you could retire and have some sort of kind of, what's the correct word, but like some sort of kind of time
frame.
Legacy, that's the word, thanks. If you had some sort of legacy or you were able to reach that potential, you would be a bit happier, but that's really it. Like,
you mentioned, I think when we talked the last time at the Balance 2020 conference, that at some point you'd like to get into coaching and management, and
yeah,
you're doing a little bit of it, are you?
Yeah, so I obviously, like, would have helped out. I'm a coaching officer in my local club, so I helped out there with the academy and the underage structures and do a bit of coaching with, like, underage.
Is that what you hope it's going to re-engage your love of the game? Because it's clear.
I don't know is the answer. I still struggle, like, to be around, you know, the senior teams and that side. Part of me is more I want to educate and tell my story and make sure that this doesn't happen, and I hope to go down that avenue and ask the right questions and put the pressure in the right areas that this doesn't happen to 18 and 19 year olds all around Ireland. And I think that's more powerful than actually coaching. But again, you still, like, you devote your life to the GAA. Like, you know, I played 10 years since I was 15 to 25 for Donegal, you know, and you still love it, but it's like a bitter sour.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing of this is that you talked earlier on about I wasn't educated at the time. You've obviously become incredibly conversant in what the procedure is, the different natures of the different types of procedures that are available, the different types of treatments. So I suspect that you've become something of, you know, you saying you rang Josh van der Fleer, who you knew. I presume you're getting phone calls from all over the country.
Yeah, so
going through the same thing.
Like when I was going through all that, you know, I actually decided to set up a rehab page because there was no information out there. You know, I think it was
one on Instagram.
Yeah, on Instagram. So I think I was probably the first inter-county footballer to get a hip, resurfacing at that time, you know, and I've probably spoken to 50 or 60 different inter-county athletes, hurling and football, that have gone through different procedures or have got keyhole work or have gone and got it done in Ireland that needed to be referred to Coventry, you know,
So there's a bit of an epidemic of this. You know, it's not just a GAA problem where the best young kids are actually playing for too many teams, and that this becomes a conversation that everybody has, that like with your 17-year-old, if you're a parent or if you're in charge of a team, going, what other training did you do, lads? Well, what other training did you do?
I think like if we look at it and we look at like I played soccer, I played a bit of rugby, hurling, you know, as a kid, it's, you need to try every sport and you should be able to do that, but it's then when it gets to when it's starting to get serious, when you're 17 and you're getting into different, you know, kind of higher level, and kind of that's when it's needs to be managed.
When you're in
managed.
The gym doing stuff and
you're doing
different gym work for different conditioning coaches and different managers.
And at the conference, like, you know, within the GA, not every person has the right certification and is maybe telling young fellas to get to lift this weight when they might not even have the correct squat technique or lunge. And I think that's where it goes back to like long-term development and looking at the bigger picture and actually saying, right, well, here we have a talented 16-year-old who's maybe gone into a development squad. Let's screen him. Let's get data on his body. We have it in a centralised hub, right? So then when he gets to 10 years down the line, he's 24, 25, we have a full history, medical history. We know when he was squatting, his right leg was weaker than his left. We need to work on that there. That's what's been going on in professional sports, and it's only starting now in the GA in the last number of years. You know, and if I had that when I was 15 or 16 and then process was going through, we could have handled my training load and I could have said, well, look, I have this match here. This is most important. I only do, say, my conditioning-based training on a rower, on a bike or a watt bike compared to actually running.
Yeah.
Again, less impact through the joint, which means prolonging my career.
Yeah, which is exactly what everybody wants to come out of.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, I think we've covered pretty much every aspect of it. It seems like it was grim at parts, but ultimately you seem like you're a much happier person now at the other side of it.
Yeah, like you've time to reflect, and you know, there's been, I suppose, different things in my life that's happened in the last few years that's kind of maybe realise the bigger picture. You know, say this year my mum was battling cancer, she came through it and ran a marathon, and you know, you kind of look at say them small things for inspiration. You're like, you know, yes, my football career is over, yes, I have had 5 operations, my dreams are shattered and all that there, but I'm still healthy, and at the end of the day, your health's number one. And when you're an athlete and you're putting your life on hold for whatever sport, you know, the bigger picture is always going to come down to your health and the longevity and your family. Like, so I think that's, if you can get that out of today's session, you know, and just think about number one, and actually, because no one else is going to look after you, and that's the thing that we need to get to.
Yeah, and you can build on that then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, Luke, thanks very much for sharing your story with us, and best of luck with the recovery.
Thanks very much for everything.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.